After composing one of the best-loved game OSTs of all time with Journey, Austin Wintory was left wondering what could inspire him with the same intensity. Known as a top authority when it comes to composing modern VGM, every project he scores offers a new opportunity to explore and innovate. But when Stoic, a team of developers led by a trio of ex-BioWare staff, contacted him about their upcoming crowdfunded game, The Banner Saga, Austin found a veritable wellspring of inspiration. Following the mythic narrative surrounding a variety of Viking-influenced nomads and warriors, the saga is a genuinely epic tale that adapts to player choice as it unfolds. At its heart, the world is one of legend, where the sun itself has frozen in place and dead gods litter the landscape. The story is mostly told through turn-based combat and branching dialogue, while the whole experience is constantly brought to life by strong writing, distinctive art, and most importantly for this podcast, a beautiful soundtrack that shimmers with subtext. I'm Lee Tyrrell, and this is The Sound Test, where I look in depth at video game audio and music, along with the very people who crafted it. For my first episode after a Christmas break, I'm honoured to feature Austin Wintory in his first Soundtest appearance, joining me for a lengthy look at his work on the entire Banner Saga. Later in the series, you'll hear a lot more about his celebrated soundtracks for that game company, including Journey, in a special that also features Vincent Diamonte. Quite unlike the mysterious, often dialogue-free releases from that game company, Stoic's Banner Saga is heavily story-based. That gives a composer like Austin a lot to grip into, from the individual dilemmas of each character to some of the larger, more overarching themes. And then there's the setting itself, and its gestures toward Viking and Scandinavian lore. Outside of focusing on specific pieces or instrumentation, how did Austin approach his general tone when he took on the project?
I wanted it to feel mostly reflective of the kind of situation of the characters, which was very, very desperate situation, very alone, very dire, and also very exhausted. That was one of the things that I was especially fixated on, is that these are very big, burly, badass, powerful warriors, and the only thing that they want is essentially to just fall asleep. Because the storyline of the game revolves around this sort of supernatural freezing of the sun in the sky. And so I talked with the developers, Stoic, particularly the writer Alex Thomas, and said, we kind of dug into that, and I said, it would seem to me that if you're in perpetual daylight, it's like that Christopher Nolan movie Insomnia, where you're going to start to lose your mind. And that these characters, every time they pick up their axe or they pick up their sword, they do so with this heavy sigh of like, my God, really? Again? That was sort of the jumping off point, more than historical perspectives or something like that. I mean, I didn't want to be I didn't want to be ignorant of those, but yeah, it actually really wasn't the sort of driving force.
The Viking influence that runs through the Banner Saga is really more of a tone. Instead of making any specific references or adapting tales wholesale, there's a sense or feeling of Norse tradition throughout. Therefore, Austin wasn't necessarily concerned with being strictly in line with the history of Scandinavian composition. It's similar to Gareth Coker's Mythology Pack soundtracks for Minecraft, which often lean into famous film music over authentic pieces from ancient Greece or Egypt. Archaeomusicology, the study of music history, is a niche subject at best, meaning that pop culture has gotten very good at representing the spirit of a time and place, without the need for painstaking accuracy.
Well, Gareth is right, first off, that sometimes the spirit of something is closer to what you want than a literal reproduction of it. That's not uncommon at all. But particularly with ancient folk traditions. But in this case also, add to that that Norse traditions, and particularly the Vikings, are largely unknown. We don't even really know what real Viking music sounds like. I did look into it when I started on the Banner Saga, but mostly out of curiosity, because it was never the goal for it to feel sort of anthropologically accurate, for the most obvious reason that the game is loosely inspired by those things, but it's very much not those things. You know, you compare the Banner Saga, it's all original characters and mythology. It's the tone of it and the kind of hallmarks of it are Norse inspired. But in contrast to a game like, say, God of War, there's no references to Thor and Wotan and any of these other, you know, archetypal figures. It is very much only the kind of spirit of it, or the flavor of it. And that was the case with the music.
The characters and their own individual arcs, as well as the setting itself, were clearly the focus of the Banner Saga's soundtrack. But the history of Viking music undoubtedly played a role under the surface. For example, Austin included a buckahorn, a genuinely ancient Scandinavian instrument, usually fashioned from nothing more than a ram or goat's horn. They typically feature 5 finger holes to play different notes, which is relatively small and melodically limited. Obviously, that's going to have an effect on how music of the time was written, helping us to understand what we can't hear for ourselves.
You know, one of the ways that you can kind of learn about what music might have sounded like from a given culture where there are no, you know, written transcriptions or sheet music left, is to just look at the construction of an instrument and see what would have sounded natural on this, because that tends to be what they do. They're not going to play something super inorganic to the instrument. The instrument design is going to chase what they were playing. I had this one musician I work with a lot, Noah Gladstone. He commissioned the custom construction of a thing called a buka horn, which is basically a hollowed out ram's horn that they then drill finger holes into, brought it over, and it was like, this thing can only really play like six notes, and of those, you know, these few sound the best. And so you start to immediately make assumptions about, well, if this was an authentic Viking instrument, then it's going to start to revolve around these very specific pitches and these very specific movement between them.
Tightly packed melodic movements, of the kind possible on a buka horn, come up across the Banner Saga. They're a clever way of evoking the right atmosphere by playing with the physical qualities of appropriate instruments. But such techniques don't define the score or turn into gimmicks. The saga established its own sound, better suited to legends within the game itself than tales of old. And by the third release in the series, the unique feel of Austin's music is sharply refined.
You know, it's just sort of my practice as a composer anyway, but also given that I had to do three scores in the trilogy, at some point it just starts developing itself, and it's no longer about that kind of touchstone of Viking sound or the Norse sound or the Scandinavian landscape or any of that sort of stuff. And it just starts to become, you know, I would write, like, especially I remember starting on Banner Saga 2, I started writing and I would just ask myself, does this sound like the Banner Saga? And by that point, the vocabulary had started to sort of settle into a place where I would be able to say, yeah, actually, you know what? This does sound like the Banner Saga, and that doesn't. And then as new characters entered into the story, finding ways to expand what that means while being authentic to it and all of that.
So, if the Banner Saga sound isn't about merely copying ancient trends, what is it characterised by? One of the first things you're likely to notice as a listener is the heavy emphasis on brass. In fact, strings, a normally common texture, are barely used in the series. A lone violin can be heard, particularly highlighting certain narrative beats, but otherwise, they're completely absent. Why did Austin decide to keep bowed strings off the score, and what separates them from other instrumental groups?
First off, strings are the most monochromatic orchestral color, meaning between the bass up to the, you know, the lowest note, the open E or C string on a bass at the very bottom of the sound, all the way up to the highest, most shrill harmonic of a violin, you have the entire range of music basically sonically covered by strings, and in a very smooth and a homogeneous way. So violins very organically give way to violas, which organically give way to cellos and then to basses. And you can create a big full chord or harmony or whatever that spans the entire hearing range of humans. And it's one color. In the same way that you can play a big wide chord on the piano and it's all piano, strings are homogeneous. And they're the only family that's sort of broadly true of. Because brass, you know, trumpets are really different sounding from tuba. It's not just that they're the high-pitched version of the same thing. They are fundamentally different sounds. And that's even more true with woodwinds. And so add to that, strings are bowed. You know, you play them with your hands. You don't have to use your lungs to play them. and so they can sustain sound infinitely, theoretically. Whereas winds and brass are limited by the sound of your by your literal physical lung capacity. And so I have always found that there's an intrinsic awareness with brass and winds, even among the totally musically uninitiated, that there's an exertion that goes into playing winds and brass that you don't associate with strings. Strings are so capable of being ethereal and magical, and part of the reason why is that it's easy to not really feel the presence of the human playing it, in the same way that, you know, especially on good recordings of brass and winds, you literally hear them take a big inhale but before a long phrase, and then when the note finally stops ringing, you could often hear them gasp to get air back into their lungs. And so I found myself just thinking, you know, this game is all about the kind of exhaustion of these players and of these characters. I mean, and what if the orchestra kind of mirrored that and we completely did away with the strings? And there's a lot of reasons for this also. Strings have a tendency to warm up the sound. And even though brass and winds are capable of being very warm and beautiful, they're also capable of being very stark and cold. And so I thought, you know, the big, long chords held by strings and winds, I'm sorry, by brass and winds, rather, has a very different and very kind of cold and even eerie quality compared to the exact same notes very warmly being held by strings.
There are still a multitude of plucked strings in the music of the Banner Saga, and we'll hear more about Taylor Davis's solo violin later in this podcast. But culling bowed strings from an otherwise orchestral ensemble is a bold move. Besides the loss of a whole texture, many of the possible dynamics that come with them go too, along with the power that extra players bring. That's partly why, rather than just cutting the strings and moving on, Austin actually increased the standard amount of brass, wind, and percussion players to compensate. After all, the games demanded force and heft in their music, and what conveys that better than thick, reverberant drum beats and layers of brass?
The brass and the winds and the percussion, that's all the loud members of the orchestra. So I thought, I want this score to feel very heavy, you know, like in that same manner of their exhaustion. It should feel very weighted physically. And so if you get rid of the strings, but then you add back in a bunch more brass, winds, and percussion, so whereas a normal orchestra would have like four French horns because they're plenty loud to be heard with only four of them against, say, 24 violins or 12 violas or 8 or 10 cellos, four horns will cut it in a, you know, in an 80-piece orchestra. And I said, well, what if we cut out all the strings, but then it's, you know, it's 9 horns, and instead of 3 trombones, it's 6 trombones, and instead of 1 tuba, it's 2 tubas, and instead of 1 timpani, it's 2 timpani, and instead of 2 flutes, it's 5 flutes, and all that. So we built the orchestra back up to, you know, 60, 70 people, but with no strings anywhere. And so as a result, they could play very quietly, but it would feel incredibly heavy. It would feel like, my God, tectonic plates are shifting. And that was very attractive to me, that because I didn't, ironically, because Banner Saga 2 and 3 are probably the most cacophonously aggressive scores I've ever written. The idea was actually to avoid that initially. I thought, I want this to feel like the weight of the world, it should not feel like the apocalypse and that hellfire is raining down on you. It should feel like extremely heavy, quiet, you know, resignation. And nothing seemed to quite nail that for me with this, other than the kind of wind ensemble sound. And that led to all kinds of fun, specific shenanigans about, like, well, where should I even record this? What musicians should I use? And we ended up recording it in Texas with a professional wind ensemble, and they had never done a recording session before. And their performance hall, the Meyerson Symphony Center, where they and the Dallas Symphony both perform, you know, was not equipped for a recording session. So I had to fly my whole crew from Los Angeles to Dallas in 1,000-degree summer heat with maximum humidity, and it was a crazy adventure that I wasn't anticipating, but just an absolutely joyous one.
Each Banner Saga game has featured a different group of musicians, besides some soloists who appear throughout the series. The first made use of the Dallas Winds, while the sequel brought in the Colorado Symphony. Finally, the Banner Saga 3 was performed by the London Studio Orchestra, though all stick to the same basic instrumental rules. No string ensemble, big drums, and even bigger brass. Unfortunately, in my time with Austin, I was unable to cover the recording sessions of every title, but I did get to ask about his experience with the Dallas Winds. Additionally, since he mentioned their facilities needed a little work for the production, I wondered how difficult he found the process.
Well, I mean, they were very, very well-respected musicians as an orchestra, so it wasn't like their lack of experience recording a score meant that I was remotely questioning the caliber of performance I would get. It was all just, can I integrate from a technical way with their facility? But I never had any doubts as to what they were musically capable of. But that said, they were so enthusiastic about the chance to do something this novel and this unusual from their normal that the vibe in the room was just spectacular. I mean, everyone was having so much fun. I got very lucky. I mean, they were really, really excited to do it, and they were incredible partners, and it took a lot of planning and coordination. I mean, it was not an easy thing to set up, but it was so worth it.
Live performances, like those of the Dallas Winds, not only help the Banner Saga gain weight and depth, but they also sum up how game audio has evolved. In the 80s, it was a significant challenge to render anything even close to a convincing brass sound on something like the Commodore 64's SID chip. Today, top-level composers like Austin can double or even triple up on real brass ensembles and record them in perfect quality. That opens the door for whole new complexities and details to master, but it also allows for an incredible freedom. Things like choirs simply weren't heard in games on a wide scale until consoles like the PlayStation popularized CD audio. It's because of that growth that textures like brass and sung voice, some of the harder sounds to synthesize convincingly, are much more popular today. Vocals make up a fair chunk of the Banner Saga soundtracks, utilizing the talents of several featured artists. How did Austin go about choosing his collaborators? And what was behind the decision to include human voice in the palette?
Andreas.
they called me when they still had 2 weeks left to go on their fundraising, and they were already, you know, 300% of the goal. And so they were saying, you know, how can we really capitalize on this momentum? One of the really high priced items on their Kickstarter was that you could basically be a character in the game, that they would model the drawings and animation after you. If you gave them like $1,000 or something pretty substantial, you could be added to the game, to the lore and everything. And the specific way that they were doing it was within the storyline of the game. The pantheon of gods are not only real, but they are knowingly and definitely dead. In other words, the gods kind of got into a big civil war at some point in the history of the world, and they legitimately killed themselves off. So it's not a folklore like, you know, I hear the gods are gone. It is a plainly known fact to the people of this world. And the reason for that being important is that as the apocalypse starts, there is no chance for a kind of Deus Ex Machina. There will be no help from above, because up above is empty. And so that was a very important part of the story, and the premise of the game. The world is dotted in its landscape with these huge, like, grave markers, basically, for the gods that are dead and gone. And so for the Kickstarter thing, it was like, you can be one of the godstones. And so send us up your photo, and Arnie will make a kind of godstone-ized version of you. And you can even write the lore so that when your characters pass by it, you can inspect it. And then the sort of bard in the group will say, ah, that's the god, you know, Dengler, who this, that, and this, that. And you can actually contribute to that writing just as a way to integrate with the community and embrace the whole Kickstarter nature of it. And I thought that was just the coolest thing. So I said, you know, what if every time your caravan passes one of these things, it's a tradition within the characters of the world to sing in honor of the god? So then I went to the Kickstarter backers and I said, I want you to tell me about this god so that I can develop lyrics inspired by your character. And then the idea would be that the caravan is singing in Icelandic as you pass by. If you start talking about singing, you can't avoid the question of, well, who's going to be the singer? And since the whole thing was born of the internet, you know, the Kickstarter is the only reason why the Banner Saga exists. And Kickstarter is such a beautiful manifestation of the power of the internet. Crowdsourcing funding, to me, is one of the most beautiful ways that you can show the interconnectivity that the internet has to offer. So I thought, well, what if the hiring of the singers follows a similar mentality or philosophy? And so I basically just said, well, who are interesting YouTubers who are making their living as musicians because of the power of the internet? And there was like this perfect storm where at that same time, incidentally, across my desk comes Peter Holland's cover of the Misty Mountains, you know, dwarven song from The Hobbit. I hear this man singing this kind of gravelly dwarvish thing, and it was so beautiful, and I just immediately reached out to him and said, I need you for this thing I'm doing. And then similarly, around that same time, a singer in Mexico named Maluka did a cover of a bard song from Skyrim that was just hauntingly beautiful. And I called her up. In fact, the Kickstarter community said, like, it was on the message board of, has anybody seen this incredible Maluka Skyrim thing? And, you know, her video was going super viral, you know, practically in that moment, and reached out to her. And they were both thrilled to jump in.
Our hero claims a warrior. I tell you the dragonborn calls with the voice wielding power of the ancient Nordar.
Peter Hollins and Maluka aren't the only vocalists to contribute their skills to the Banner Saga, and I'm going to have to apologise for my upcoming pronunciations. The first game also included performances by Johan Sigurdsson, who appeared again on Austin's third soundtrack for the series. With each sequel, more singers entered the fray, such as Holly Sedelos for the Banner Saga 2. That second title incorporated more clearly Nordic voices too, specifically Astadir, an Icelandic band from Reykjavik with a penchant for classical sounds.
We added another group on Banner Saga 2 called Arstíðr, which was the same thing. It was a band from Iceland that had a video go viral on YouTube of them singing an Icelandic hymn in a subway station. And these five guys singing like, you know, this music that was this perfect intersection of very masculine and macho and very delicate and beautiful. And I just thought, that is the Banner Saga. So I reached out to them, and they had never worked on a video game before. They weren't even gamers. They were like a rock band, but they said, sure, why not? And that was especially nice because they are actually Icelandic. So poor Peter and Maluka had to suffer learning how to pronounce Icelandic, which is incredibly difficult. Whereas with these guys, it was easy. So that was a nice little bonus. And then the third soloist to join in was Ivor on Banner Saga 3. She's from the Faroe Islands, which is right off the coast of Iceland, basically, kind of halfway between Iceland and the UK. I just came across a video of her singing on YouTube. She's a lot more established of like a solo artist and does music that, you know, is very kind of authentically Faroese and Icelandic and Nordic, but then also stuff that's almost like straight pop music. And she also does like grand cinematic epic stuff. And she's a composer. She was working on a TV show. And so I just cold called her and got on the phone with her management and said, you know, I'd love to write a kind of finale end credit song for the Banner Saga 3 to round out this trilogy, and I'd love for you to sing it. And the ironic thing is I reached out and she was already about halfway through working with my friend Bear McCreary as a featured soloist on God of War. And so I was like, then I guess I definitely came to the right source. And she did a phenomenal job as well.
The large number of collaborators who run through the Banner Saga are essential to its sound. Vocal performances from a wide range of talents significantly deepen the atmosphere and connect directly to the story, lore, and characters. Austin often draws intricate thematic parallels in his compositions, which you'll hear a lot more about in his upcoming That Game Company episode. But one of the most prominent examples in the Banner Saga is Taylor Davis's violin. Its use in all three scores is so closely tied to the narrative that this next section comes with a spoiler warning. Those who haven't yet completed the series may wish to skip ahead to avoid ruining anything. So what gives the solo violin its special place in the soundtrack? And why was Taylor Davis chosen to play it?
Nested within the grand end of the world story of the Banner Saga is this father-daughter struggle. As they are, they're basically like simple kind of provincial farmers who are caught up in all this craziness. And spoiler, you know, at the end of the first game, you have to make a decision as a player that will end up killing one or the other. And so Banner Saga 2 and 3 are both kind of on, they're both two games in one on parallel path where, depending on who survived at the end of Banner Saga 1, that becomes the central character then for the other games. And so it's either a daughter struggling to live up to the legacy of her father and learning to kind of be an adult sooner than she was expecting to have to be an adult, and to also be a leader of a bunch of people she doesn't know in a situation she doesn't understand. Or it's all of those things as a guy, as the father, who's grappling with the meaninglessness of having lost his daughter. And the way it has left him feeling adrift in the world. And so there's this very, very intimate and emotionally powerful heart at the center of the kind of main player character. And I wanted there to be a unique instrument distinct from all the rest that we kind of associate with that. I wanted to break my kind of no strings rule with a one lone violin. And around that time, this violinist, Taylor Davis, did a cover of Journey with this incredible music video where she's in cosplay and she's in the snow and on sand dunes. And so I just called her up and said, "You are incredible. This is by far the best cover anybody has done of Journey. And I'd be honored to work with you on the Banner Saga." And so I called Taylor, and she has a really nice violin that, you know, she paid a bit of extra cash for, and is kind of her main instrument. And I said, "Do you have a cheap, crappy one, like a violin that you would have practiced on as a kid that's just overtly not very high quality, and that you could play like a little out of tune and things like that? Because that's what I want. I want something rustic, like a folk instrument." And so she dug up an older violin that really wasn't very attractive and kind of put it a little bit out of tune and played with almost no vibrato and all that kind of thing. And that's sort of how we built that sound and then developed that over the course of all three games.
Taylor's violin, in its isolation, looms almost as heavy across the Banner Saga as the booming brass itself. And even after all this discussion of different instrumentation, there's still much that Austin and I were unable to cover in our time. Subtle electronics, affected electric guitars, and even a didgeridoo can be heard as you progress through the games, all adding to the score's thick, cacophonous blankets of tone. Of course, behind it all is the ever-present rasp, quake, and rumble of brass, which, like the bass guitar, is something I play myself. I'm amateur at best, and much more of a hobbyist than a proper player, but my experiences playing the cornet have been enough to show how utterly singular the brass family is. Just producing a single note with perfect clarity is a posing challenge at first, and at higher levels you can encounter all sorts of unusual techniques and playing styles. To what degree do such approaches show up in the Banner Saga? And how important was that kind of experimentation in general?
There's not a lot of unusual techniques. I do a lot of aleatory, so there's a lot of kind of free-for-all anarchic chattering throughout all three scores in a way that's almost classical modernism. But it's all about letting the brass just resonate through a big warm hall, because that sound is just unlike anything else. Brass can do just unbelievably huge amounts of stuff, and it's just really, really, it's really beautiful and exciting. And you know, it's one of those, we definitely could go on forever and ever about it, just because it's such, there's such a wonderful group, and I had such a wonderful time, you know. And each score ended up having little bits of difference in their execution. You know, for example, the Banner Saga 2 was recorded in Colorado with the Colorado Symphony, and then Banner Saga 3 was done in London with a session orchestra at Air Lyndhurst, and all of that kind of ended up affecting how things played out. And so it's all kind of an endless, it's like a fractal thing where there's just more stories at every turn, because it was 6 years of my life, you know, working on almost 2 hours of music for each game and just, you know, pouring everything into it. I really can't overstate how much I love that franchise.
The fact that Austin and I spoke as much as we did about the Banner Saga shows just how much he loves the series. We had already discussed that game company for over an hour, and I expected to get little more than 10 minutes bonus material on his work with Stoic. But, as soon as the subject came up, Austin launched directly into the insights you've heard in this podcast. Still, there are many stones left unturned when it comes to his trio of soundtracks for the saga, and hopefully we'll get another chance to chat in the future. There's always more ground to cover with projects like this, especially when Austin brings so much genuine passion and drive to his music.
If they called me tomorrow and said, we've greenlit 10 more Banner Saga games, I'd be over the moon, because it's just hands down one of the best experiences I've ever had. I grew so much. It was so creatively like having this incredible physical trainer that just pushed me to the brink of what I was capable of. And I'm so grateful for that. And I love those characters, and I love the art style. You know, Arnie Jorgensen's just incredibly beautiful Ivan Durrell-esque aesthetic. And it's just every detail of it, to me, is just a dream. And I never thought, I shouldn't say never, I was prepared to never feel that way again after Journey. I thought, you know, I'm probably ruined now, and I'm just so spoiled by such a special experience that nothing will ever excite me like this. And then it was like a day after Journey ships, I get a call from Stoic, who are running their Kickstarter for the Banner Saga, and said, take a look at this. And it's just instantly in love again.
Thanks to Austin for speaking to me for the sound test, but thank you too for taking the time to listen. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please make sure to follow or subscribe on whatever platform you may be listening on. There are still many episodes to come in this second series, with its opening six and the first season freely available through just about every popular podcast provider. Next up, I'll be setting sail on the Sea of Thieves with Robin Beanland, one of Rare's very best composers, whose career can be traced all the way back to classics like Donkey Kong Country and Killer Instinct. Another future episode will feature Robin discussing his legendary work on the N64. But if you want to hear that Sea of Thieves episode right now, ahead of public release, then head on over to patreon.com/_secretcave. There, you can pledge your support for as little as a single pound or dollar to unlock early access to podcasts, unedited interviews, full quality WAV files, a backlog of otherwise unavailable live shows, and more. Either way, I hope you enjoyed this return to ST2 after a Christmas break. And don't forget to join me every Friday at 7 p.m. GMT for a live and interactive show of VGM Celebration.